I have a son who is a great young man. He's a fine person. I took a meeting with a lawyer from Russia. It lasted for a very short period, and nothing came of the meeting. And I think it's a meeting that most people in politics probably would have taken.
The president, 3 weeks ago, talking about the meeting his son Donald Trump Jr. had with a Russian lawyer. When the news about the meeting first broke, Donald Jr. released a statement saying it was primarily about a program for Americans to adopt Russian children. But that fiction didn't last long. It quickly came to light that the meeting was really about damaging information the Russians wanted to share about the Clinton campaign. So why did Trump Jr. come out with that first misleading statement? Well, according to the Washington Post, he didn't. His dad did. Nick Johnston is an editor at the news site Axios, which covers Washington and politics, among other things. Hi, Nick.
Hello.
Okay, well, first, take us quickly through the steps of what happened after the New York Times initially reported this meeting between Trump Jr. and the attorney, Natalia Veselnitskaya. What are the important things we learned about that meeting in the last few weeks?
Right. The Trump administration, Trump campaign, was very quick to say this was an innocuous meeting. It was one of many meetings they were having during the campaign. And it certainly wasn't related specifically to sort of campaign issues. It was more about this adoption issue, which is related to sort of an ongoing diplomatic feud between the United States and Russia. And as intrepid journalists at the Post and the Times kept digging, they were able to discover that it was actually around more than that. And they got very close to sort of Donald Trump Jr.'s true explanation that he'd been promised dirt on the Clinton campaign. And that was the emails that Trump Jr. released right before the Times published them to say that it's actually very much about the campaign. So the true meaning came out. And so what we've discovered here is this wide gulf between what they knew the meeting to be about and then this statement, intermediate statement that was put out with Donald Trump's, the president's blessing in between. That
right.
was inaccurate.
Okay, so then it comes out in the Washington Post that the president, when he's on the plane coming back from the G20 meeting on July 8th, decides to pretty much write the statement or at least dictate the statement that says it is primarily about adoptions. So, so that comes out. And today, White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders is asked about it, and here's what she said.
Like I said, the statement that was issued was true and there were no inaccuracies in the statement. I think what the bigger question is, everybody wants to try to make this some story about misleading. The only thing I see misleading is a year's worth of stories that have been fueling a false narrative about this Russia collusion and based a phony scandal based on anonymous sources.
Okay, so she's basically saying the statement was true and yet it didn't include the Clinton campaign information in it.
Right. And this is where I think it gets dangerous, where the Washington Post reported where the president's advisors are concerned. And that when you're parsing language like this, it becomes very legally problematic with a special counsel like Robert Mueller looking at these kinds of things. What we've encountered a lot in our own reporting, writing about Donald Trump, is that he says these things and speaks very much off the cuff like he would a real estate developer. But when you're dealing with these kinds of legal issues, you can get yourself in trouble. Remember the original reason the travel ban was taken to court was because of what Donald Trump tweeted about it. We've written that he's endangered his trade agenda because of the way they phrase it, the way he's talked about it. And now the way he's talked about this Trump meeting, his meeting with his son, means it opens up ways for Robert Mueller to then go and look it up. Well, then was he parsing this language incorrectly? Was these are attempts to obstruct justice or to obfuscate legally what was happening on that meeting? And remember, in these kinds of investigations, that's where you get in real trouble.
Right. Not the crime, but the cover-up. However, this statement was a press statement, so he wasn't making a statement to prosecutors. He wasn't under oath. I mean, there's no crime to lie to the press, obviously. Happens all the time.
No. That's true. Not you can lie to me all at once, but is this part of a broader effort to trying to direct or obfuscate what these things were really about? I mean, and this is the legal danger of all these kinds of things. If we're talking about just the press and there's no special counsel and there's no congressional investigations, well, say whatever you want. Like, this won't be litigated in a court of law. But when then there are legal machinery involved, then remember, Robert Mueller and these very experienced investigators and these attorneys will go over every line of every one of these emails and every one of these statements, and they will have subpoena power and they will pull these documents and they will look very closely at what is said and whether it holds a more stricter standard of a rule of law, whether they're just making press statements. And I think that's what the president's advisors are concerned about, according to the Washington Post.
Yeah, and on top of that, there seems to be a discrepancy within the White House because Sarah Huckabee Sanders says that today, yes, the president did weigh in, that those are her words,
right,
on the statement. And yet his attorney told CNN that, and this is a quote, "I wasn't involved in the statement drafting at all, nor was the president."
Right. Exactly. Like, he did weigh in. Well, what does that mean? I mean, the horrible comparison I'm going to make here is what President Clinton happened during his impeachment proceedings. It depends on what the meaning of the word is. And when you go down that path, I think you're opening yourself up to lots of different kinds of legal jeopardy, especially when there are special counsel and congressional committees investigating.
Right. Okay. So I guess it's this whole idea of smoke and fire. And, you know, this is a week that perhaps the president didn't want to be talking about Russia again, but here we are talking about it. So
right,
how distracting is this? And are congressional Republicans getting a little fed up?
I mean, congressional Republicans are happy to be not distracted, I think, by the Obamacare replace and repeal right now, and very much looking forward to talking about tax reform, or actually more important, looking forward to going home for the August recess next week. We hadn't talked about Russia a lot, but of course we hadn't been talking about Russia a lot lately because we were in the process of going through a new communications director and the chief of staff was being replaced. So there's always sort of something new angle here. I think it is important that what this story reminds us is that bubbling beneath the surface of all this, Robert Mueller and the special counsel is still hiring attorneys, is still collecting documents, is still going like line by line on his probe. And so there is very much more to come.
Nick Johnston, editor at Axios. Thanks for joining us.
Always a pleasure. Thanks.
We're going to talk more now about the relationship between Russia and the United States. Tensions are increasing. Russia is getting ready to send as many as 100,000 troops to its western border for some military exercises. Those exercises have been planned for a while now. But when you put them together with the current diplomatic fights, the expulsion of more than 750 American diplomats and staff, sanctions passed by Congress, when you wrap all that up, you may think we could be entering into a new Cold War. So are we? Here to talk about that is Alexandra Vakhruv. She's executive director of the Davis Center for Russian and Eurasian Studies at Harvard. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Okay, so quick answer, are we entering into a new Cold War?
Well, we've been talking about this for the past two or three years, actually, since the invasion of Crimea in 2014 and Russia's disruption of eastern Ukraine. A lot of people are sitting around asking if this is a new Cold War. And I would say that the big difference between now and the Cold War before the Soviet Union collapsed is that we are not in an inevitable ideological conflict with Russia. We do not pose an existential threat to Russia, and Russia does not pose an existential threat for us. And the fundamental definition of a Cold War was that you had two enemies that were bent on destroying each other.
Right. However, diplomatically, are we in a tough spot now, a tougher spot than we've been in a bit?
Diplomatically, things are pretty bad. I'm not sure they're worse than they were immediately after the Russians annexed Crimea in early 2014. Then you saw the Europeans and the United States come down very harshly in terms of economic sanctions on Russia. And Russia was very determined to kind of push back and to show that it was strong and that it was going to be controlling its post-Soviet space. But I don't think that things are getting any better. And if this exercise had taken place, let's say, 3 weeks ago when we were still talking about that nice warm handshake and conversation that Putin and Trump had at the G20 summit, it would look a little different than coming a week after the discussion of new sanctions. And I think that that context makes it look like it's potentially more of a threatening operation than the military exercise necessarily is.
Yeah. So what are these military exercises for? They're being conducted in Belarus.
Yeah, I mean, these are exercises that happen every few years. They happened in 2009 and 2013. And military exercises are kind of like scrimmages that football teams have when they're not playing their opponents. They're actually scrimmaging to do practice things. We had one in Romania, actually, just a couple of weeks ago called Saber Guardian with the NATO troops, and the Russians were pretty exercised about that also and pretty upset about it. But in the normal course of business, militaries have exercises with and against each other, and it's a completely normal part of military readiness for all armies. So the fact that there is an exercise is not in and of itself a sign that things are getting worse.
Do the Baltic states have reason to be nervous when they look at what happened with Crimea and what happened there in terms of the annexation? Do they have reason to be worried, especially when President Trump has not issued a full-throated support for NATO?
I think the situation in the Baltics and Crimea is really very, very different. I mean, Crimea was Russian until 1954 when Khrushchev transferred it to Ukraine, and it was primarily Russian, populated by Russian speakers who, in an admittedly flawed referendum, agreed that they would rather be part of Russia than part of Ukraine. Now, it was still annexation of foreign territory, but it was annexation of territory that Russia felt it had more of a right to than, say, the Baltic countries. The Baltic countries are distinct countries. They have never belonged to Russia per se. They were a part of the Soviet Union after World War II, but they are very clearly now in NATO camp, and I don't think that Russia has any interest in fighting NATO, which is what would happen if they invaded any of the Baltic countries. So they are nervous. I mean, it is living next to a neighbor who's potentially threatening, but I don't think that there is an imminent risk that they're going to be invaded.
Okay. Well, let's talk about what's happening with the sanctions and the expulsion of diplomats. Is that just a lot of noise and not much behind it, or is there something serious going on behind that?
The sanctions are pretty serious, actually. They haven't yet been signed into law, so they've cleared both houses of Congress, and it's one of the rare instances where there is unanimity between the Democrats and the Republicans. And Trump has said that he will sign them. The real problem with the sanctions, so there are two real problems. One is that they are targeting Russia's energy infrastructure, and they're targeting programs and different projects that European companies are involved in, and that the European companies may end up being collateral damage for these sanctions. And that has Europe extremely upset, particularly Germany. Hmm. That's a serious problem. The second problem is that once you have a piece of law like this on sanctions, it is extremely difficult to get it reversed. And the example that we look there is Jackson-Vanik, which was introduced in Soviet days because the Soviets weren't letting Jews emigrate, and it took about 30 years to lift those sanctions, even long after the Soviet Union had disappeared. So once you have a piece of legislation in place like that, it really limits the room for maneuver and the room for improving relationships in the future.
Targeting the energy infrastructure, could that do a lot of damage to Russia's economy, which is already suffering from low oil prices?
It's not really something that would hit the economy in the short term. It affects Russia's ability to invest in pipelines, which is more a question of what their economy looks like 5 or 10 or 15 years down the road. I mean, to be fair, they have done a lot of reorientation to the Chinese market and to Eastern markets, and this would affect primarily their actions in Europe. So I don't think that that would have a measurable hit. The real problem is, though, is if it affects the European investments into some of the Russian companies. And that's a problem for the companies themselves, if not the overall economy. The real problem with the Russian economy is the low oil prices. It's not the sanctions, and it's not a kind of a lack of American investments. It's the fact that it's extremely dependent on oil revenues. And when the oil price is low, their tax revenues are very low.
Okay. And looking at the relationship between President Trump and Vladimir Putin, what do you make of it? It seemed that it was a very warm relationship, and now the president says he's going to sign the sanctions bill. So how do you assess their relationship now?
I don't think that the Trump signing of the sanctions bill is an indication of what his relationship to Putin is. I think that there you see kind of a political calculation that if he doesn't sign it and then it gets overturned by Congress, his veto gets overturned, which is very likely, then it's another blow for him for his domestic agenda. I think he would rather not sign it, but he's been pinned into a corner. And the fact that the Congress voted so overwhelmingly for these sanctions means that he's got no choice but to sign them. That being said, I mean, Putin's response to eject these, the staff members from the embassy, only some of whom are American, most of them are actually Russians who work at the embassy, that's an extremely measured, mild response. If Putin really wanted to show that he was extremely unhappy with the United States, there are a lot of other things he could have done that would have been much more serious. One thing, for example, is that NASA is completely dependent on Russian rockets to get to the space station. Now, granted, we pay about $1 billion in 2017 and 2018 to use those rockets, but if they had cut off cooperation between the space agencies, that would be a really serious blow. Reducing the embassy staff is extremely inconvenient, and there are programs that are not going to go forward, and the Russians are going to wait longer for their visas. But that's a pretty mild response on the scale of things.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
No problem.
That's Alexandra Vakru. She's executive director of the Davis Center for Russian and Eurasian Studies at Harvard. Coming up, how millions of Russians got their ideas of America through the soap opera Santa Barbara, and how they may have been right. Next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. All right. 1980s daytime soap opera fans may remember that song as the theme from Santa Barbara. The show ran for nearly 9 years on NBC to little fanfare. It was, frankly, a B-list soap. But in post-Soviet Russia, Santa Barbara was must-see TV for tens of millions of people in the 90s.
What are you, drunk?
Ты что, пьяна?
Я
пьяна.
Wait a minute!
Да что с тобой? Фильмов не смотрелось!
The show's sunny beaches and convoluted plotline were a window onto a better life, an escape from hard living in a country turned upside down after the Cold War. Mikhail Yosol is a professor of English at Concordia University in Montreal. He grew up in the Soviet Union and has a piece in Foreign Policy about how Santa Barbara, the soap, explains the way Russians see the United States. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, describe for us how popular Santa Barbara was in the 90s in Russia.
Well, massively popular. It was a borderline national obsession. Tens of millions of people, as you said. And by the time on a nightly basis, the show would be playing streets of big Russian cities and small Russian towns would be cleared out of people. Missing an episode was considered personal tragedy and had to be caught up somehow, and people were just living a parallel life through that show. It was the first American soap opera to be shown in post-Soviet Russia and the only one, and it was massively popular.
And was it because it was the only one, or was it something about Santa Barbara?
It was a combination of things. It was, of course, a window onto America. It was a time of great confusion in Russia when the terra firma, the certainty of Soviet life, was over and nothing has yet replaced it. And so people were sort of like suspended over the dark entropy of their lives, and they were hoping that at some point their lives would resemble, in some distant kind of way, the lives of people in Santa Barbara. That was their version of paradise to some extent, and also an investment of hope that at some point Americans would help us, the post-Soviet Russian people, to live lives remotely like the ones that are lived by people in Santa Barbara, which is to say in, carefree, void of any trouble, mainly dedicated to their personal problems, people, impossibly handsome people in tuxedos and ball gowns, walking around the house and talking about personal relationships, and having the luxury of never once mentioning politics, never once thinking of Russia, never thinking about how not to go hungry, never thinking of what's going to happen to my life, and so forth.
Clearly a fantasy. I mean, the show is clearly a fantasy. And
Yeah. And
so different from Russia in so many ways, and so different from the Russian character and the Russian soul. I mean, this is a nation that has a long, proud history of literature, of classical music, of poetry, of art that is serious and not frothy. So did Russians really take this show seriously?
Well, not everyone in Russia took it seriously. It was tens of millions of people, granted, but it's still a country of 140 million plus former post-Soviet territories. So lots of people did, though, because quite frankly, yes, Pushkin, Tolstoy, Chekhov, Dostoevsky, and look where it got us. What do you get for this heightened degree of spirituality? Is it that good? maybe Americans know something even if they don't read books.
And yet, actual communities were built throughout the Soviet Union with the name Santa Barbara. So people were trying to make it a reality.
Yeah, of course. You try to make paradise reality. It's like you go and you see like best burger in the world. You know that that's not true. It's not best burger in the world, but you know, it's a dream. or number one crab shack in the United States. It's not, but it may be. If you name something Santa Barbara, you know, the most decrepit and dolorous of neighborhoods would start looking better to you somehow. Mm-hmm. And same with restaurants, and same with all kinds of establishment, coffee houses, strip joints, anything. Santa Barbara.
Strip joints.
It's good luck.
Well, the show ended its Russian run in 2002. How did viewers feel about it when it ended?
Well, it's sort of like ran its course because 10 years counted for many tens of years in Russia, that those years between 1992 and 2002, several different layers of Russian life had passed over that period of time. And so there was a nascent disillusionment with America, a nascent realization that America was not going to embrace us, post-Soviet us, and to make our lives just as good as people, as American lives. There was also already first kind of rumblings of anti-Americanism introduced by Putin and the first injection of anti-Western poison in Russian kind of societal vein. So all that already was underway, and already it was the wearing off of the first phantom pains of former superpower. You know, it's 10 years was the period of time that in real time that Russians start realizing that they're no longer a superpower. And suddenly it was wounded pride. And suddenly it was the realization that we used to be, okay, no one liked us or loved us, but everyone was afraid of us. And now no one is afraid of us, in addition to no one liking us and so forth. We used to be a great, great superpower. And now what are we now? Santa Barbara was instrumental in that. It gave them an outlet on the world that might have been, could have been. They knew that it existed somehow. They didn't know that it didn't exist. They thought it was actually the way it was, the way Americans lived their lives. And that was very appealing.
Well, now it seems like it does exist in the form of our current president. You write that he seems to embody one of the characters on Santa Barbara.
Well, he certainly wears tuxedo a lot. Yeah, he's very kind of Minikin kind of character. He's completely, there are no chiaroscuros to his character. There are no half tones. He's strictly a negative character from Santa Barbara, but also very immensely rich, a billionaire, right? Like C.C. Capwell, and also engaged in complicated relationships with women, but also kind of oddly charismatic. And so on. And just, yeah, he is indeed the first Santa Barbara character that Russians can relate. Bill Clinton was not, George W. Bush was not, Barack Obama was not, but Trump, absolutely.
Mikhail Yosel is a professor of English at Concordia University in Montreal. You can read his essay on Santa Barbara and why Russia sees America, or why it did see America, through the Santa Barbara lens at Foreign Policy. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
And we want to hear from you. Did you watch Santa Barbara when it was on TV here in the U.S.? You can tell us why on our Facebook page or Twitter at KCRW Press Play. And coming up on the program, Venezuela is sliding toward dictatorship.
Maduro is not just a bad leader, he is now a dictator.
The future of Venezuela, will have that next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. A political opposition leader being taken away by armed men in bulletproof vests in the middle of the night last night. Just the latest sign of the gravity of the situation in Venezuela. This past Sunday's election gave the president, Nicolas Maduro's party, complete power. It was an election considered a sham by most people. Here is National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster.
By designating Maduro himself, he joins a very exclusive club, including Mr. Mugabe, Bashar al-Assad, and Kim Jong-un, in terms of the brutal repression of his people, and in this case, the abrogation of the Constitution with the Constitutional Assembly.
The Trump administration imposed sanctions against Maduro. Daniel Landsberg Rodriguez consults on Latin American geopolitics and teaches at Northwestern University, and he joins me now. Hi.
Hi, thank you for having me on the show.
Great to have you. Well, we heard tape of an opposition leader being taken from his home in the middle of the night. Another one was picked up as well and put in jail. What's the significance of that?
So the two opposition leaders who were essentially kidnapped this morning are Antonio Ledezma and Leopoldo López, who are two of the most well-known prisoners of conscience in Venezuela. They had been, for various reasons, given house arrest in the uptick to the Constituent Assembly, a period when the opposition and the government were negotiating behind closed doors if there could be a solution that would come instead of changing the creation of the Constitutional Assembly, which was essentially a nuclear option by the government that's essentially hijacked all power from both the population and other institutions. So this is really a statement that's being made, partially in reaction to a feeling of strength or a sense of being stronger as a result of the sham elections held over the weekend. But also it is a response to the growing chorus of international criticism that the government is getting. It's increasingly isolated. It's increasingly cornered, not just by the United States, but many countries in Europe, Latin America, including its neighbor Colombia, Brazil, Mexico, most of the larger countries in Latin America. They've all agreed that this process was undemocratic.
Right. What is the explanation then on the part of Maduro and his supporters for, first of all, arresting these two opposition leaders in the middle of the night, and then also holding this election that everyone is saying is pretty much a sham? What is the possible explanation besides a desire to consolidate power?
Well, desire to consolidate power, seen through a different lens, can be also a desire to protect power or to protect sovereignty. The government, which has essentially destroyed free media in Venezuela, I had a column at El Universal, Venezuela's oldest paper, for years. That paper was bought out by people allied with the government, and every critical voice was fired. They have bought out or taken over every television station that's not cable, and that could potentially reach into the poorer classes, which it considers its base, in which it has a monopoly not only of influence and of support, but also of communication. And that has created an ability to create what we would consider outlandish, perhaps, conspiracy theories, blaming all of the problems Venezuela has, be it 750% inflation, be it harrowing shortages of food and basic goods, be it collapsing infrastructure, falling oil rents, street violence, on shadowy cabals of international enemies seeking to undermine the revolution. So in the government's own arguments, the Constitutional Assembly is a way of strengthening the revolution against these various invisible threats that are responsible for the precipitous decline in living standards that have taken place in Venezuela in recent years.
And so what is the reason behind that? Because there was a worldwide drop in oil prices that a lot of people are saying, well, that's the primary reason. Isn't 95% of the economy or the exports based on oil? Is there anything to the fact that there is some kind of outside pressure for Venezuela to do things that it doesn't want to shortchange the revolution that is in perhaps contributing to this? Or is it all because of this geopolitical problem with oil prices and the fact that Venezuela is so dependent upon them?
Well, it's great that you point that out. Obviously, the Saudis are quite dependent on oil. Canada, although they don't want people to notice, is relatively dependent on oil, as is Norway. And there you can find medicines, you can find food. They're not seemingly having the same problems as Venezuela is, even if some of the oil money that they may have gotten 5 or 6 years ago is no longer coming in. This is a result essentially of two things. One of which is the fact that Venezuela, it's a bit like the Aesop's fable of the grasshopper and the ant, that one stored up food during the harvest and the other one fiddled away and then had to come and ask for food when winter came. That's essentially what Venezuela did. Under Hugo Chavez, Venezuela was quite profligate with its expenditures, not just on social programs domestically, none of which were terribly efficient, but some of which were aimed at doing really good and important things, but also on trying to turn this mid-sized, middle-income country into a world power. And the way they did that was by subsidizing oil shipments to Cuba, subsidizing oil shipments around the Caribbean. They paid for Carnival in Rio 1 year. They were buying Argentine bonds right after the default for geopolitical reasons. They bought an air force from Russia, even though Venezuela has not actually had a war since independence, to try and create geopolitical strength. Chavez saw Venezuela as the spearhead of an international revolution. That was a very expensive process. And when oil prices came back down, because these things tend to be cyclical, there was very little money left in reserve, to the point that even during the boom times, Venezuela had been borrowing money to pay for various projects. And that's the situation Venezuela finds itself in now. So first off, it has far fewer in reserve than a lot of the other oil countries. And secondly, there's an arcane currency mechanism that allows the government to approve and to give foreign exchange. You can't change currency freely as you would in most or in many countries, but you have to get permission from the government to use it. This was a way in which the government could basically have complete control over the private sector. That has also created a situation, however, where importers need to get money, need to get foreign currency from the central government to be able to import. And Venezuela, which has been an oil country for a century, has really no domestic capacity to be able to generate enough food, to generate any medicine or other basic goods, things like nails, shoes, anything else. And so all of that has to be imported.
And leaving it now in a state of crisis, actually, and on the brink of something even more dire. We have to end it there, unfortunately. Daniel Landsberg Rodriguez.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me on the show.
My pleasure. He teaches at Northwestern University. Coming up on this program, how pro-life forces are winning in state houses across America and now in the White House, next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Pro-life activists are winning their long war against legal abortion. Even though Roe v. Wade is the law of the land, a new documentary paints a picture of a systematic and effective campaign to chip away at it on the state level. Birthright, a War Story, depicts an attack launched from all sides, from pre-pregnancy to sterilization. Director Sivia Tamarkin is here with us now. Welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, you paint the beginning of this, at least the concerted wave of chipping away at Roe v. Wade on the state level, at around 2010 when the Tea Party comes into power. So connect the dots for us, because the Tea Party was a national movement to get people elected to Congress. How did that then translate into a movement at the state level to chip away at abortion rights?
Well, you have to go back to the passage of Roe v. Wade, because that was a declaration of war by opponents of reproductive rights. And they had been strategizing since the early 70s and have slowly decided that the way to succeed was incrementally aligning themselves with politicians. And so they infiltrated the Republican Party. They formed alliances within that party. They sought Ronald Reagan, who, of course, as you know, had signed very, very progressive.
He was very pro-choice for a long time.
Pro-choice legislation as governor. And then the Republican Party saw an opportunity by hooking up with the evangelical Christian right. They had an opportunity to bring a lot of people into the tent, a lot of funding into the tent. And so the platform changed.
Now, tell us about this one woman you profiled in the film. She took half a Valium during her pregnancy, and she was prosecuted for that?
She lives in Alabama. Alabama is one of the more notorious states in terms of policing the womb, if you will, and manipulating child endangerment statutes that are on the books in a way that pregnant women are under threat, and it's all part of a strategy in that state to establish the personhood. So this woman, Casey Sheehy, took a half a Valium. She was later in her pregnancy. She was having a very difficult pregnancy, suffering from preeclampsia, etc. And she had an argument with her former husband over their older child. And she was very upset and very agitated. And her mother said to her, "You have to calm down. You have to take something or you're going to lose this baby." And so she took half a Valium so that she would calm down and rest. She delivered shortly thereafter, a few weeks later, and Alabama would do drug testing without consent, by the way. And she was drug tested. And it turned out that there were still traces of that Valium in her system. And so a few weeks later, she was back at work, and three officers came to her workplace and said, "We have a warrant for your arrest."
For child endangerment?
For child endangerment, correct. They called it chemical endangerment of a child.
And that is technically illegal under Alabama law.
Right. There was a law that was established under the old methamphetamine crack cocaine mom laws. And it was intended to protect children who were in homes where there may have been, you know, meth tubs in the bathroom there. However, the law has been manipulated in such a way to include in utero, children, as they define them. And so she was one of the women, one of more than 500 women swept up in this law.
500?
More than 500
women in Alabama. This is happening in other states as well.
This is happening all across the country. In fact, there was a fetal protection law in the state of Wisconsin under which a woman who showed up for prenatal care was very excited about her pregnancy and told one of the physicians, "I'm so delighted I'm pregnant because years ago I did have a prescription drug problem." They immediately called the authorities. She was arrested. When she protested, she was put in solitary confinement and shackled. Her fetus received a court-appointed guardian ad litem. She had a difficult time getting an attorney herself. And the Wisconsin law was appealed. It went to the U.S. Supreme Court. And only about a week or so ago did the Supreme Court decide that Wisconsin could reinstate this fetal protection law, which, of course, meant that pregnant women were at risk.
I mean, it's tempting to look at a story like that and say, "Oh, my gosh, this can't be the norm. I mean, this is too outrageous to believe that a woman just casually talking about drug use from years ago would end up in this situation."
Well, I think that there is a lot of hysteria over the push to eliminate abortion, and women are being ensnared into this. There was a case in Iowa where a pregnant woman fell down the stairs, went to the emergency room, and, you know, begged, "Please, is my baby okay? Is my baby okay?" And the authorities there, because They are mandated child abuse reporters call the authorities under suspicion that she may have deliberately thrown herself down the stairs. There's a recent case going on in Washington State where a woman had a stillbirth, and she is now being prosecuted on the grounds that she did not obtain proper prenatal care. So when you start pushing the personhood statute and concept to the point of conception, then you are basically saying that the state has the authority to interfere in a woman's life from the moment she becomes pregnant, saying what she can or cannot do. And that's a very frightening concept.
When you look at the totality and you look at these various examples, that some of which you've just mentioned, you see perhaps some good intentions, like with the Alabama law, to protect children who are caught up in meth labs, for example. And then you see how that is being overly interpreted, to put it charitably, right, by other people. Do you see this as isolated examples of certain people taking things to the extreme and perverting the law for their own ideological reasons? Or do you see this as a more systemic, systematic attempt to deny women control over their reproductive health?
Well, I think it's both. I think the answer is yes to both, that certainly there are zealots within the movement, the anti-choice movement. There are people who are manipulating laws in order to create a body of jurisprudence that will establish the personhood and constitutionally protected rights of a fetus. But it is indeed part of a widespread, nationally organized, systematic movement. You know, we now have a rearmed Christian right, and they feel the opportunity is there for the taking. And they have been pacing themselves incrementally since 1973 when Roe was passed. And now they are springing in action, and they're lying in wait for the right cases to bring forth to challenge Roe v. Wade.
So they're not giving up on that while they're working on the state level.
Right. It's operating on both fronts. They're doing laws to restrict access to abortion. They're trying to establish the personhood laws. And at the same time, they're looking for cases that will come through the ranks and rise up as a potential challenge in the Supreme Court.
And where's the pro-choice movement?
That's an interesting question. The pro-choice movement, unfortunately, was blindsided, if you will. You know, I mean, in fairness, there was a victory. You won at the Supreme Court level. You attained a right under the protection of the Constitution. And so you move on to other agenda. I mean, if a woman can control her own reproduction, she can control her own life. And once you can control that reproduction, you move on to areas of education, you move on to areas of economic opportunity and mobility. And so the movement began to focus more on wage disparity and political opportunities, job opportunities. Unfortunately, they became complacent, and they let their guard down, and little by little, they ended up on the defensive, while the other side was aggressively on the offense. And now they are scrambling to defend the ground that they have, and there's little opportunity to form a solid movement. I mean, I personally think there's really no unified leadership. There's no unified, cohesive mission. You have a lot of individual groups that are fighting for survival.
And this, the other side, the pro-life side, has been working at this, as you say, for decades, a long time.
Exactly. They've been working at this for, 44 years.
And so what do you envision in the next few years with this administration and this new Supreme Court?
I think with this administration, it's terrifying. First of all, we saw the position that the Republicans were taking on women's health care in their proposed health care bill, the Trump care bill. Even though it did not pass, even the slimmed down version at the moment, no one thinks that it is dead. And we all know that they're going to try to regroup. But what's terrifying is the idea that 13 Republican men sat behind closed doors and decided that maternity coverage, prenatal coverage under Medicaid for poor women should not be part of it. They also decided that cesarean sections were a pre-existing condition, which therefore would raise one's monthly premiums and make insurance prohibitive for so many people. But while all eyes were focused on that bill, very few people were paying attention to the hammering from the top that's going on in the Department of Health and Human Services, because we have a staunchly vigorous Secretary of Health and Human Services in Tom Price, who is opposed to abortion, who is opposed to contraception, who has enlisted the former Charmaine Yost, the former founder and director of Americans United for Life, as his deputy. And they are determined to craft legislation, or regulations rather. And it's very telling that Vice President Pence, while there were no public hearings on the health care bill, that Vice President Pence was also meeting behind closed doors with leaders of the Right to Life movement and getting their input on what should be in the health care.
Do you think Roe v. Wade will be overturned?
I fear that there is a strong likelihood if Trump has two more opportunities, even one more opportunity, to appoint people to the Supreme Court. I mean, we're certainly hoping that Kennedy does not resign and that Ruth Bader Ginsburg remains healthy and on the bench. But if he has an opportunity, I think there's a very, very strong likelihood it will be overturned.
Well, I want to thank you very much for coming in today.
Thank you for discussing the urgent and important topic.
Sivia Tamarkin, she's the director of the new documentary. It's called Birthright, A War Story. The film is currently playing at the Lemley Music Hall. And Christian Bordahl is here with a quick
listener feedback segment. Well, fun segment earlier about how the soap opera Santa Barbara was so popular in Russia. Tens of millions watched it and they thought, you know, they were getting some insight into how we live here in Southern California.
Gideon Emery, in America, in general, I guess.
How wealthy we all are. Well, Gideon Emery says he loved that bit about Santa Barbara's impact in 90s Russia. He says South Africa was also hooked on its wealthy drama / dramatic wealth. So I guess it wasn't just the Ruskies that enjoyed Santa Barbara, the soap opera.
Who knew?
Exactly.
Well, maybe it's time to check out some old issues.
Soap operas?
Old episodes of it. I don't know. Maybe it's newly relevant. Thanks for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.